Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Dennis Richardson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He addressed us some years ago when he was Director General of ASIO, and that was a fine evening, and we're very grateful that he's found time to come back again in a busy schedule. So I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Educated at the University of Sydney, entered the Commonwealth Public Service, had various important departmental positions in immigration and, of course, Prime Minister and Cabinet. Prime Minister of Cabinet, he also worked for the Hawke government. Was appointed Director General of ASIO in 1996, a position that he held until 2005, and from 2005 Mr. Richardson's been Australia's ambassador in the United States, and today he's going to speak for us on Australia and the United States. Many thanks, Ambassador.
Thanks, Jared. Very happy afterwards to take any questions on any particular matter. The only thing I will say up front, I don't want to disappoint anyone, but I won't be answering any questions that seek to take me into the Australian political arena in any shape or form. As Jared said, I'll talk on Australia and the US, and very happy to take any questions on that afterwards. 200 years ago, Thomas Jefferson was serving his second term as US President. Jefferson, who often thought aloud about the future, considered that the United States would always be, quote, puzzling and prospering beyond the imagination of mankind, unquote. 200 years later, Jefferson's observation remains valid. The United States continues to be a great engine for global economic growth, scientific innovation, applied research, new investment. In addition, the United States continues to puzzle constructively and purposefully about its role in the world. Its role as a sole superpower in the post-Cold War world and in a world of asymmetrical threats. It also puzzles about moral and other challenges. The few blocks around the Australian Embassy in Washington, for instance, plays host to some of the most high-powered and thoughtful puzzlers in the world. In the Brookings Institution, Johns Hopkins, the Carnegie Endowment, the Centre for Strategic and International Studies, and the American Enterprise Institute. The United States remains an indispensable country. That phrase is borrowed from Madeleine Albright, the former US Secretary of State under Clinton, because the point she expressed was, and still is, compellingly true. For whatever we want to do in the world, for our own national security, our own economic prosperity, our own foreign policy priorities, and our own trade agenda, the United States is an indispensable nation, as it is for the rest of the world. That fact neither diminishes our independence nor our identity. Overwhelmingly, the US remains a force for good in the world, whether it be fighting AIDS in the developing world, researching and fighting malaria, responding quickly to disasters globally, or seeking further global trade and investment liberalisation, a critical issue for Australia. There is often a speculation from time to time about whether the US is losing its economic clout. A few facts provide the answer. The United States is the largest economy in the world, with GDP of nearly 14 trillion. Measured in purchasing power parity exchange rates, the United States produces about one-fifth of the world's output. In terms of market exchange rates, it accounts for about a third of global output. The United States is the world's largest exporter, and it is the world's largest importer. It imports on average nearly 20% of all internationally traded goods. The United States is also the dominant influence on world financial markets. Its stock market capitalization is over 40% of the world's total. It issues around 40% of the world's debt securities, and its banks hold about one-seventh of the world's total bank assets. With its large current account deficit, it imports well over 60% of the world's capital. Given these strong trade and financial linkages, it is not surprising that economic and financial developments in the United States are felt worldwide. Research published earlier this year by the IMF concludes that there are substantial spillovers from developments in the United States to the rest of the world, and that these influences have not diminished over time. Indeed, they appear to have increased. The United States is not only the largest economy in the world, it is also one of the most efficient. It produces nearly a third of global output, with less than 5% of the world's population. The OECD estimates of labour productivity show that the rest of the OECD is on average 25% less productive than the United States. So the US is also a technological leader. While there has been some convergence between other countries and the US over the years, and new economic powerhouses such as China are emerging, one should not lose sight of the large and continuing economic presence of the US. Longer term projections, such as those of Goldman Sachs published in The Economist last year, project that the US will remain the world's largest economy at least until 2040. Australia's economy is about 6% of the size of the US economy. In absolute terms, our economy is small compared to the US, but relative to others, we're also big. Of the 191 members of the UN, 185 have a smaller land area than Australia, 140 have a smaller population than Australia, and 178 have a smaller economy than Australia. It is important to be conscious of our size relative to most others, as it is all too easy for Australians in the United States and elsewhere to become mesmerised by the size of the United States itself and to underestimate our own weight. Equally, because it is so long established and works relatively smoothly, it is easy to underestimate the breadth and depth of our bilateral relationship with the US. Australia's economic relationship with the US, encompassing both trade and investment, is by far our largest. Two-way trade in goods and services is worth almost $47.5 billion in calendar year 2006, up 11.7% on 2005. The US is our third largest trading partner, but it is in the investment arena which makes the big difference in the economic partnership as a whole. The US is Australia's largest single source of foreign investment, and I think that would surprise no one. However, we are the eighth or ninth largest foreign investor in the United States. Of the 191 countries in the US, we have more foreign investment in the US than all but another seven or eight countries. something which surprises many people, but which shouldn't, considering the size of our own economy. Indeed, the US is the main destination for Australian foreign investment abroad, taking about 38.4% of our investment going offshore. And we now invest almost as much in the US as what the US now invests in Australia. And the free trade agreement, which came into effect in January 2005, is a positive in all of this. In terms of breadth, our relationship with the United States has equal depth in matters of defence and national security, which would surprise no one given the formal alliance. The same is true when it comes to culture, whether of the Hollywood kind or other. Where it can be surprising is in the sheer scale of the people-to-people dimension, with some 100,000 to 130,000 Australians living and working in the United States. Wherever you go in the United States, and in whatever field of endeavour, you come across Australians in senior and other positions across the full spectrum of business, academia, and the professions. And the vast people-to-people network has its emotional ties, such as through the 10,000 to 15,000 Australian women who married US servicemen during the Second World War. That Australians and Americans can live and work together so comfortably is in large part because of the simple things often taken for granted, speaking the same language and living in societies which, however different, share a common sense of what is right and what is wrong. US global priorities and how it views the rest of the world is important to us all, whether we like it or not, both because of its economic weight and because it is the sole superpower. And there are issues of enduring importance to the United States, the perception of which is sometimes coloured by the prism through which each of us might view the current administration. Those issues of enduring importance to the United States can be relevant to our own national interests, and because of that, we should have some understanding of them. And it is in this context that I want to say a few words about each of 9/11 and terrorism, proliferation, Iraq and Afghanistan, East Asia, energy and climate change, and global trade and protectionism, and you won't be here all night. 9/11 remains a basic reference point for the United States, not just for the Bush administration, and it will remain so for at least another generation. For the United States, issues of terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and proliferation are fundamentally linked. For the United States, the possibility of nuclear terrorism is seen as a real threat to be addressed, not as an abstract notion. It is a concern driven not so much by fear, but by hard-headed analysis, the certain knowledge that terrorists want to obtain weapons of mass destruction, and if they do, their target of first choice will be the United States. Listen to this extract from a recent article in the US press, and I quote, "The probability of a nuclear weapon one day going off in an American city cannot be calculated, but it is larger than it was 5 years ago. Potential sources of bombs or the fissile materials to make them have proliferated in North Korea and Iran. Russia's arsenal remains incompletely secured 15 years after the end of the Soviet Union. And Pakistan's nuclear technology, already put on the market once by Abdul Khan, could go to terrorists if the president, General Musharraf, cannot control radicals in that country. More nuclear materials that can be lost or stolen, plus more terrorists aspiring to mass destruction equals a greater chance of nuclear terrorism. If I said that extract was from an article written by former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, I suspect there would be much less surprise than if I said, as is the case, that it was actually written by one of Bill Clinton's former Secretaries of Defense, Bill Perry, and it appeared as an op-ed piece in the New York Times on the 12th of June this year. Those concerns, which I quoted, go across the US political spectrum. They are not confined to one side of US politics. The depth of concern amongst Americans of all political persuasions is not, I believe, fully and properly appreciated in all countries, partly because they know the threat is not directed against them, and therefore they don't feel it the same way. This can play into a certain lack of urgency in the way some countries tackle the issues, and this only heightens concern amongst US policymakers. And it is not a good thing for any of us if the world's sole superpower feels a certain insecurity in this way. The possibility of nuclear terrorism is one of the elements in the concerns about proliferation, especially in respect of Iran and North Korea. This is understandable given North Korea's poor record on proliferation and Iran's support for Hezbollah and Hamas, the former being a terrorist organisation with global reach. As with nuclear terrorism, Iran and North Korea will remain US priorities beyond the current administration. And contrary to some media speculation from time to time, the US remains committed to seeking diplomatic solutions through the six-party talks in respect of North Korea and through the P5 and E3 in respect of Iran. As in Australia, the war in Afghanistan is not a matter of partisan political difference. It remains identified in the US with the security of the homeland because of 9/11. In respect of Iraq, it is important to distinguish the theatre of the debate in the United States from the substance of the debate. It is certainly a very unpopular war in the United States. That is clear from all the polling. However, while much attention is often on issues such as, will the Congress supply funding for the war? Will the Congress impose timetables for withdrawal? The real substance of the debate in the United States is on the most appropriate mission for US forces in Iraq. With the major presidential candidates on the Democratic side supporting the need for a continued US military presence in Iraq to train and support the Iraqi security forces, to fight international terrorism, to provide force protection, and to provide a rapid response capability. In other words, a continuing force of anywhere between 50 and 80,000 troops, depending upon how one measures the need. All major presidential candidates in the US consider that Iraq and the wider region remain essential to US national interests and cannot be walked away from. For all the obvious reasons, China, Japan, and India will remain key US interests for many years. And it is those relationships which will shape the broader politico-strategic context in which we in Australia live. In particular, how the US and China engage and manage their relationship will be fundamental. To date, and going back to 1972, there has been a degree of strategic vision on both sides. Indeed, one of the overlooked achievements of the Bush administration has been the significant improvement in its bilateral relationships with each of China, Japan, and India. And this is in Australia's own national interest. A few months back in Washington, 15 Chinese ministers and vice ministers met together with a majority of the administration's cabinet. That is now the intensity and level of the engagement, and it's a reflection of the seriousness with which both Beijing and Washington approach their bilateral relationship. As in Australia, there is no single view in the US of China. Some are fearful, some are suspicious, some are hostile, and some are hopeful and confident. There are obvious issues and points of friction, ranging from trade to defence expenditure, force posture and transparency. But steadily, structure and machinery is being put in place, enabling such issues, hopefully over time, to be addressed sensibly. That is something we should all welcome and encourage. Energy security and climate change are now bigger issues in the US political and policy debates. The administration remains philosophically committed to technology and the market as major elements in addressing greenhouse gas emissions. It is opposed to mandatory caps, but a new administration in January 2009 could have a different approach. In the meantime, the administration has become actively involved in the global dimension and the global debate of climate change, as witnessed through its involvement in the P6 Clean Air and Climate Initiative in early 2006, involving also Australia, Japan, Korea, China and India. Through the G8, through APEC, the UN and its own initiative in bringing together in late September in Washington the world's 15 largest emitters. So there is a certain active engagement internationally by the US on climate change. This will continue, in my view, as a permanent feature in US diplomacy. But one comment in respect of any post-Kyoto arrangement. In my view, no US administration of any colour will be able to be part of any post-Kyoto arrangement unless there is a clear pathway for the involvement of the major economies of China and India, especially China. US domestic politics would simply not allow the US, in my view, to be involved in a post-Kyoto arrangement that did not have a clear pathway for China's involvement. As the world's largest exporter and importer, the US has a strong interest in a more liberalised global trade and investment environment. But Doha remains unfinished, and the President's Trade Promotion Authority expired in June and is yet to be renewed by the Congress. Within the Congress itself, there are renewed protectionist elements, and this is something which we will need to watch, for instance, in the context of the Farm Bill, which can affect Australian interests. I suspect that any gain made by protectionist elements in the Congress will be limited, as fundamentally it would not be consistent with the US's own national economic interests to go too far down the path of protectionism. In conclusion, I can only say that if Thomas Jefferson was alive today, he would be delighted with the amount of puzzling still going on about the US. And being in Washington in the Australian Embassy, that is, of course, part of our role. The Australian Embassy in Washington essentially does three things. First of all, it's paid by the Australian taxpayer. To be the Australian government's think tank in Washington. Secondly, it's paid by the Australian taxpayer to be the Australian government's lobby group in Washington. And thirdly, it's paid by the Australian taxpayer to provide a range of functional services across the full spectrum of government activity, ranging from trade through to immigration, to consular, to education and the like. That's all I wanted to say by way of the speech. I'm very happy, as I said, to take any questions on anything I said or on any related issue. Simply to go back to my starting point, your prerogative to seek to engage me on matters that might link me into Australian domestic politics. It's equally my prerogative to decline the kind invitation.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.